Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Ladies and gentlemen, today is day two on the Radio Cafe of the KSFR Fun Drive. It's the day, as is every day this week, when we ask you to go to your telephone and call 505-428-1393, 428-1393, and make a donation to KSFR, the station that you listen to and that makes such a difference in your day. And if you are a regular listener to the Radio Cafe, it's the day that I ask you to say, if you like the show, then please just pitch in. And it's a great day to do it because we are talking today to Mark Winnie. He is the author of the book Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we're going to be giving away copies of this book to people who donate to the station today. So 428-1393 is the number. I know that many of our listeners are people who think about where their food comes from, who shop at the farmer's market, who try to buy organic food. And even if they don't do those things, they're thinking about it. They're concerned about it. This is a book that's kind of a guide that helps you go forward in your thinking about this and helps you think about these basic questions like, where does my food come from? 505-428-1393 is the number to get a copy of the book and to learn about Mark Winnie. But we are delighted and happy that we have Mark Winnie here right now. So let's just talk for a second. We have, as you outline in your book, a real contrast. It's between the industrial agricultural system and the alternative model. And in a way, it's sort of funny to call it the alternative model, because the alternative model is, I guess, the way things have been done for the first 10,000 years of agriculture.
It's That's right.
The agricultural model. You grow stuff, you have local markets, you eat from local markets. Suddenly that's become, it's really a David and Goliath thing. It's that's the little player now.
That's
what
right.
happened?
Well, it always reminds me of a little story I tell about this old Connecticut farmer I used to know, because I'm formerly from Connecticut, and he was in his 70s when organic farming suddenly became very, very popular, and the prices of food, organic, suddenly shot up. And he realized, God, this is the way I've been growing food my entire life. Now, suddenly, I can actually make a living at it because I can. People will pay more. So it's there is an irony here in the fact that, for up until just after World War II, most of our food was produced using organic, sustainable methods, not dependent in any significant way on huge energy inputs, and certainly not dependent on agrochemicals and pesticides and the other things that have proven to be very problematic ever since World War II. And while we had our ups and downs in terms of food supply during that period of time, for the most part, we were eating pretty well. In fact, for many of us, we were actually healthier because we were thinner. And then suddenly we're into this position of relying on industrial methods of food production. We wanted to increase yields substantially. We wanted to kind of push Mother Nature's envelope as much as we possibly could. And we started to use more in factory-style production, more like almost imagine the way that a car is made on an assembly line. That's the way we started to look at agriculture in food production in this country. And, of course, that required enormous inputs, and there was enormous costs. And Rachel Carson was probably the first person to tell us what those costs were starting to look like. And
What were some of those costs besides just capital of buying tractors and petrochemicals and those kinds of things?
Well, we began to see the decimation of the wildlife. We began to see the pollution of water, runoff from farms going into rivers and estuaries, eventually finding their ways into something like the Gulf of Mexico, where we now have an area of dead zone that is, I think it's about the size of the state of New Jersey, where almost nothing lives.
And why is that?
because of all the pollution, all the agrochemicals, all the fertilizers, insecticides, herbicides that washed off the land from the farmland into the Mississippi River Basin and found their way out into the Gulf of Mexico.
And this was, of course, before any oil spills.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the damage that's been done by agriculture far, at least to the Gulf of Mexico, far exceeds the damage that's been done by, you know, even, you know, the recent BP.
Yeah, nobody knows this.
No, well, I think it's fairly well known. I think it's fairly well known that that kind, I mean, that's, you know, certainly one of the more evident and, you know, destructive aspects of agriculture that we've seen. But I think the other toll that's been taken is on our own bodies, of course. I mean, we've gone from being a relatively thin and healthy people, at least from a dietary point of view, to being a terribly overweight and obese people. You know, 65% of the people in this country are now either overweight or obese. Diabetes, particularly among children, type 2 diabetes is out of control. It really is our biggest public health crisis, and in the opinion of many, has eclipsed tobacco as being our public number one public health problem.
We're talking to Mark Winnie, and by the way, you can call and get a copy of his book, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, 505-428-1393, 428-1393. Why is it that the food that is worst for you, processed food, junk food, soda cans, things like that, are so much cheaper than food that's good for you?
Well, again, they've been produced in a factory-like way, which means they're produced less in a less costly way. There are efficiencies associated with the scale of any operation. Much of our agriculture is not paying the full cost. In other words, they're not paying for the pollution. They're not paying for what happens downstream, so to speak.
The medical costs.
The medical costs, the health costs, the pollution costs. Somebody else cleans that up. They rely often on low-paid workers, many times immigrants, many times people who are being exploited in one way or the other. A lot of costs are, in effect, deferred to later generations and to other places.
And there's subsidies.
And there are subsidies. Now, you know, after all this abuse of our industrial, caused by our industrial food system, we turn around and subsidize them. I mean, it almost seems like some kind of slightly, you know, masochistic enterprise when you look at it. And, you know, billions and billions of dollars are transferred from the taxpayer to large industrial farming operations, and as well as some kind of medium-sized farmers as well. So that keeps the cost of basic products like wheat and cotton and soybeans and rice as low as they possibly can be.
It would be interesting to do the calculation if you took the taxes that every human being, I mean, every citizen paid in taxes for, let's say, corn subsidies and added that to the price of a bag of corn chips.
Right.
What it would really cost.
Right.
Medical costs aside, just the farm subsidies.
Yeah, I know. And I still don't get it. I mean, I went and I paid almost $5 for a small box of Wheat Chex the other day in the supermarket. Now, even with all these subsidies, you know, why am I paying, I think it was about 14 ounces of product inside that packaging. So we're paying for the advertising, we're paying for the packaging, we're paying for the distribution, we're paying for everybody along the line is taking their cut, and we're paying $5 for almost nothing. But, you know, there are many ways that our food system is just out of joint, out of whack, and, you know, tilted towards extinction. And unless we get some kind of control over this, we're going to be headed to, I think, into some sorry straits.
We're talking to Mark Winnie. It is the KSFR Fund Drive. Please give us a call at 505-428-1393. And you can get this wonderful book, very readable book. And we're going to talk about this in a moment, but a lot of Mark's own experience going all over the country and talking to people and being in the stinkiest feedlots known to humankind and being in wonderful urban gardens and everything else. 505-428-1393, and score a copy of the book and read it, and also above all, make a contribution to your public radio station, KSFR. The privilege of having a community station that actually responds to and is here for the people of this community from Albuquerque to Taos and beyond. We've got listeners listening online at ksfr.org, really all over the place. I've got listeners in other countries, and we have listeners in all over in many different states. But the privilege of having that is not to be taken for granted, and it's something that a couple of times a year we ask you to contribute to paying for. We are listener-supported public radio, and therefore we need our listeners to support us. Just to break for a second, Mark, are you, you're a KSFR listener?
Of course. It's required, isn't it?
It is not required. It's voluntary, as are these contributions.
Of course.
But why do you listen?
I think it's because it's the only place I can, within my, the reach of my radio, where I can hear intelligent discussion, good music, the issues that really matter to me. You know, here we are. We're talking about food. What's more important than food? You know, where else on the air am I going to hear some discussion about the food and our food system? I mean, this isn't just sort of, it's good that it can be entertaining, and I try real hard to be as entertaining as I can. But at the same time, you know, this isn't just a nicety anymore. This is a necessity. You know, we have got to pay attention to what's going on. And what better medium than the radio to get that information out there?
505-428-1393, Mark Winnie and his wonderful book. Now, when we talk about industrial agriculture versus basically local independent agriculture, it sort of sounds like a lot of things. I mean, industrial publishing, you know, bookstores versus small independent bookstores and things like that. There's so many examples. It's, same thing goes for media, too. You have these huge media corporations, and then you have these few little private independent media stations at TV and radio like us. Same things goes for newspapers. Mm-hmm. It's the system that we live in tends toward, if not monopolies, large-scale, ever more consolidating ways of doing things. And we could talk about media, and we can talk about books and all those other things until the proverbial cows come home. But with the food system, it is particularly urgent because without abundant and sustainably produced food, you have pain, suffering, hunger, starvation, riots, revolution, and all kinds of nasty things that we don't want.
Yeah, which are taking place now in other parts of the world. I mean, in Egypt, for instance, a household there spends 38% of their annual income on food. And, you know, 38%. In the United States, it's under 10%. Lower income people spend up to 15%. And so as soon as prices go up a little bit in some place like the Middle East or North Africa, the people take to the street. And oftentimes, you know, the dictator's head rolls. Or they head out the back door of the palace, which has happened recently. So this isn't, that's why I say, this isn't just a nicety anymore. It's not just a case of it's great to have a lovely farmer's market to go shopping at. It's also about what is the future of our food supply in the world. You know, we're expecting 9 billion people by the year 2050. That's an increase of almost 50% from where we are now. And many agricultural experts have predicted that it's going to be very difficult to find enough land and production capacity to be able to feed those 9 billion people. So, in a sense, we all share responsibility for that task. Now, the industrial food system is telling us, well, how are we going to feed a hungry world with that many people? Well, trust us. Trust us, the industrial food system, with our factory production techniques, with the use and overuse of antibiotics, with the increasing use of agrochemicals, the use of GMOs, and other biotechnology. Trust us to feed a hungry world. And that means that we're going to get bigger. We're going to become more capital intensive. The small guys are going to disappear. It's the same old story. But, you know, there's really, it's all based on a lie, and the lie being that they alone can feed a hungry world, that there are many other ways to do that.
Well, not only is it a lie that they alone can do it, but reading your book, what I get is if we entrust them alone to do it, we are facing a crisis of major proportions because the way they're doing it is, I mean, this is an overused word, but it's not sustainable. It's sort of like giving a quart of blood a day without letting your bone marrow replenish it,
exactly.
pretty soon you're going to be blood dry.
That's right. And they're not, again, they're not paying that bill. You know, we're not asking them to pay for that overuse of our natural resources. They don't know, honestly, what the long-term impact is going to be of the use of genetically modified organisms in agricultural production. There's a tremendous amount we don't know about the road that we're being forced to go down. And I tell you, the thing, though, that concerns me more than anything else, and it, you know, holding aside what the negative impacts might be of the kind of food that the industrial food system produces, is the basic loss of our democracy. And who will be making the decisions about our food system? Is it going to be, will it be you and me? Will it be at a community level? Or you know, how much does any family have opportunity to have some to say in how our food system works? I think it's going to be left more and more in the hands of large corporations who are going to really, through their wealth and through their influence, will be able to determine the direction of our food system. And this is incredibly disturbing to me because it means that our voice, the consumer's voice and the citizen's voice, is going to be left out of the discussion almost entirely.
And the other thing that is so obvious that it almost doesn't need to be stated, but it does, is that their interest really isn't in feeding us. It's in making profits. I was once, when I first graduated from college, I went to work for a company, and they were making computer systems for basically manufacturing. And we did a focus group, the famous focus group. And we had people from all different areas, all different manufacturing areas. And one of them was a dairy. It was in Connecticut. And a man from the dairy, who was a manager there or maybe the owner, said something which I've never forgotten. He said, look, we're not here to make milk. We're here to make money.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that certainly has, it's certainly the underlying motivation. And, you know, and it's, I know a lot of farmers, and I know farmers that use a lot of industrial methods that I don't like. But I also know that there's a lot of them that are really good people. And they really do care about what they're doing. But they find themselves forced into a situation over which they don't have much control. Do they want to stay in business? Well, they have to get bigger or get out. That's the old saying. And in fact, that still remains true. You want to stay in business. You want to have a decent livelihood. You want to be able to send your children to college or even have a two-week vacation every year. Well, you have to start using more capital-intensive forms of food production. You have to use more biotechnology. You have to invest in more equipment. It's kind of almost a death spiral that they get forced into. In my book, I talk about the case of Boulder, Colorado, which is a really interesting story where publicly owned land was about to be used for the planting of genetically modified sugar beets. And these farmers came to the city or the county of Boulder and said, can we do this? And ultimately, after a long hearing and discussion process, the county said no. And so the farmers all said, well, you're going to put us out of business if we can't use genetically modified sugar beet seeds. Well, what we found out afterwards is that Monsanto had basically eliminated the production of conventionally produced sugar beet seeds, the only sugar beet seed on the market for any commercial grower anyway, was genetically modified. So they are being forced into a box where they have no choice.
You mean that you literally can't buy sugar beet seeds?
They could not anymore. You could 95% of the sugar beet seed that's on the market that's commercially available is genetically modified.
Now, let's talk for a moment about not what we don't know, but what we do know about genetically modified foods and how harmful they are or are not.
I'm not going to get up and make a statement about how good or harmful genetically modified organisms are. I think you know what is different. Let's keep in mind what's different about this. And I would, you know, there was a couple of weeks ago, there was a great piece in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, about genetically modified seeds and food and what the effect that it's having on farming. But I do think that there is this, you know, it is a an unnatural process whereby we are going directly into the genetic material of plants and animals and manipulating that material, which is very different than the past practices of hybridization, where we would basically cross-pollinate plants using more or less natural methods that would often occur in nature anyway.
In order to get seedless grapes.
Seedless watermelons to get... To make our tomatoes a little redder, or maybe to bring out certain highlights or certain flavor characteristics. I mean, these are good things, and they've been going on now since I think was it Peter Mendel in the monasteries of Europe would do this kind of work. GMOs is a vastly different animal. You know, it's one that. The outcomes and the consequences of which we don't know what they will be yet. And I don't care what scientists say about how good they might be for our ability to increase yields. We know that there's a lot we just don't know about it. So I'm going to just hold that one aside for a moment. And I'm going to say that my problem with GMOs is more about how I don't have the opportunity to say yes or no.
Right.
And that this is being foisted upon us by the industry, and it's being foisted upon us by our own government, which seems to be, going hell for leather to approve as much genetically modified plants and animals as they possibly can. Alfalfa, sugar beets, salmon are all items, food items that are now being, increasingly scaled up to, first of all, to be approved by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for commercial use, and will then become the more dominant form of that product in the marketplace.
We're talking to Mark Winnie. He's the author of the book Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. And once again, this book can be yours, ladies and gentlemen, if you call right now, 505-428-1393, 505-428-1393. It's a wonderful book. It's published by Beacon Press, hardcover, and it's worth reading and kind of savoring because there's so many interesting stories in it. I mean, you, Mark, went around to some of the best and worst places in the country.
Yeah, no, it's well. In court, I'll just say that if you don't own this book, you're going to be really left out at the next cocktail party. You go to.
That's right.
Yeah, you'll be out of it completely.
With other KSFR listeners.
Oh, right. Yeah, you'll definitely be in the loser corner. So I would encourage you to get the book, read it one way or the other. Anyway,
Let me just give the number one more time. 505-428-1393.
Right. And I have had the opportunity through my work since I've been in the community food field, running nonprofit food organizations and organizing farmers markets and doing policy work at the local and state level. I've been at this now for almost 40 years. And it's given me an opportunity to meet a tremendous number of people, great organizations all over the country who are my food rebels, guerrilla gardeners, and smart cooking mamas. And I just had a incredible occasion to get into Cleveland, Ohio, where they were incredible devastation from the deindustrialization, the downsizing a city to abandoned properties, houses being torn down, and now a huge amount of vacant land in a city.
Foreclosures,
the whole sort of devastation of the changing American economic and industrial structure. I mean, if a steel plant closes down, the neighborhoods then dry up, people migrate out of the city, and they've gone from 1 million people to 500,000. They've lost half their population just in the last 15 years. So, in a way, it's kind of a sad story. But on the other side, people are saying, wow, well, now we have all this vacant land. What can we do with it? We can put it into food production. We can start to do urban gardening, even urban farming.
So they're literally digging up asphalt?
They are breaking the asphalt up with picks and sledgehammers. They even when that is too arduous, they have actually brought in vast amounts of compost and dumped it literally on top of the tarmac on a parking lot.
No.
And it's like, I see this pile that's like 3 feet high. It looks like this little mesa top in this parking lot. and then they trench it out in the top, and they backfill that with some soil. And they grow their food right into it. They pull, they have this incredible Rube Goldberg creation of gutters and downspouts running off of nearby housing rooftops and garage rooftops, coming in, feeding barrels, which then feed just by all by gravity into the garden, so-called garden. That's their water supply. So very inventive. And as a result, you know, people are growing their own food. The community is a little bit stronger socially than it used to be. And one thing they comment about is often it kind of pushes crime out. I mean, where these parking lots have been turned into, you know, drug dealer connection zones, they've now become you know, food production zones, and the drug dealers have gone somewhere else. So, you know, there's a lot of these very positive outcomes that come from something as simple as putting seed into some kind of medium and getting the community involved so they can produce their own food. And it's, you know, my sort of quintessential guerrilla gardener in my book is a guy named Maurice Small, who's this, you know, incredible sort of Johnny Appleseed sort of character. He's this, like, you know, very tall, lanky black guy with Rasta curls kind of gushing out of his head. And he's just in these big glasses, and he runs all over town in this old 1971 pickup truck. And just planning, helping, but not just doing it himself. He's empowering other people to do this, to find solutions themselves and try to help themselves. And that's the stories that I really want to try to tease out of these communities and try to bring that inspire other people to do something similar.
And these are communities where you've got kids who think that vegetables come from cans.
Yeah, exactly. That vegetables come from cans, or they probably don't eat vegetables at all, or if they eat them from cans, that's probably the reason they don't like them. The other thing about Cleveland and many other cities is that they're raising chickens, and they've passed ordinances now allowing people to raise chickens in their backyards in city lots, anywhere you only have a little narrow kind of, you know, few thousand square feet, and to keep beehives. I mean, what are kids thinking? Well, kids are thinking that, you know, chickens have six legs because that's how many come in a package.
Right.
But if you can raise chickens in your backyard, kids have a whole different experience of food, where it comes from, and a reconnection to nature, which, you know, we've tended to undervalue in many ways over the last several years. And the more we can reconnect to nature, in this case through food, then the stronger we're going to be, I think, in terms of our ability to cope with some really bigger problems that we have in our country.
And if you think about the example you just gave, my suspicion is that a lot of these African-American people who are living in Cleveland are just a couple of generations away from having migrated from the South, where they were sharecroppers and were doing all that stuff anyway. So
yeah, that's often the story. I mean, that is definitely the part of the story in the in much of the urban areas where I did my research, is, and I've worked and lived myself, that the Hispanic population, African-American population, oftentimes Eastern European populations are not far removed from the fields and the farm at all. Their food traditions and foodways are very powerful and still exercise a profound impact on their lives. But, you know, they've sort of slid into the same thing that we've all slid into, is that we're going to get our food from the supermarket, we're going to get it from McDonald's, we're going to get, you know, we're going to join the fast food nation sort of mentality that is just too much, has been so harmful in this country. And they lose connection with their roots and their agrarian past, you know, some of which honestly wasn't so wonderful, but much of it was. And they reconnect with the better parts, and they start to learn how they could bring their cooking traditions back into, you know, up to date. I talk about a great program in Austin, Texas, called the Happy Kitchen, and you know, working with mostly lower income moms. Mostly African-American and Hispanic, recent immigrants from Mexico in many cases, who describe coming to the United States and immediately gaining 30 pounds because they all start eating at McDonald's.
Right.
And they realize how harmful that is, and they see how diabetes has decimated their families. And they look back on their own food traditions, and they start to say, well, you know, we learned how to cook pretty well in most cases, but we often didn't cook with a lot of knowledge. We didn't have all the information. So we bring together the good parts of our tradition using mostly unprocessed healthy food ingredients, and then taking out the lard, taking out some of the other, taking out the salt, taking out a lot of that, the sugar and so forth, and learning how to cook well and healthfully using those good ingredients. So they do that, bring those traditions together with our own knowledge, and they then become, you know, the smart cooking mamas.
The number is 505-428-1393. It's the KSFR Fun Drive. We want the phones to ring off the hook for the entire hour, 505-428-1393. You can get a copy of the book Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture by Mark Winnie. And he is the one who is joining us right now for the whole program today. We're going to take a break and go to the control room and get a report right now. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back with Mark Winnie. And once again, it is the KSFR Fun Drive, 505-428-1393. Make a contribution. We ask you just a few times a year. And there are people who are probably listening right now who are very interested in this idea of where this question of where does my food come from? What do I want to be eating? How can I have a healthy life? How can I have a healthy diet? How can I prevent some of these horrible dread diseases that you just mentioned, Mark, a few moments ago, diabetes? And this is a wonderful place to start with this book, 505-428-1393. And if you like this conversation and the kinds of conversations that you hear on the Radio Cafe and on KSFR, then that is reason enough to call, whether or not some of you already have the book. Some of you already read the book. But, you know, if this is something that interests you, give a call right now, 428-1393. Now, Mark, let's talk for a second about this question. I mean, I was reading the book, and with a lot of the questions that we have here, I mean, it's a question of politics, it's a question of democracy, as you talk about. It's a question of numbers. How much land do we need, and how do we farm it so as to best feed the most number of people in a healthy manner? And right now, the people who are doing the healthy kind of farming account for only a very small portion of total land, of total agriculture, whether we're talking about New Mexico, whether we're talking about any other state in the country. So what would it take? I mean, do these industrial farms need to convert to, if not organic farms, at least more conventional agricultural, conventional in the sense of the history of agriculture, more based toward not monocrop, not capital-intensive farming, but really more human-scale farming? Do they have to change? I mean, how is it going to, how do you see the transition?
It's multifaceted, and it is really complicated in some ways. In some ways, it's fairly simple. I mean, it's a case of you know, the consumer saying, you know, unequivocally, we want food that's produced in a sustainable way. We do not want the chemicals and the antibiotics and the GMOs that are being sort of force-fed to us. If someone is going to do that, we want information clearly stated on labels in the store everywhere that tell us what is in this food and what is not in this food. There are many ways from the consumer driving the industry and the industry beginning to change its practices. But I do think that there's something perhaps we might consider doing at the local level. You know, something as simple as saying, how much land do we have in any given area, a region or a state, or even within our own county? How much of it can be used for food production, or how much of it at least can be held aside for food production? How well can we assist young people or people who have not farmed yet who want to get into farming, giving them an opportunity, or people who grew up on a farm but don't have access to land that they need? You know, right here in Santa Fe County, we have the county right now is looking at a whole land use plan, a whole way of changing the way that we think about growth and conservation and planning around our land use. And we have a Santa Fe Food Policy Council here in the city of Santa Fe, City and County Food Policy Council, that's trying to work with the county, with the planners, to see how much land can we hold aside and which land should be kept open for food production. And how about the water? Of course, here in the Southwest, water is the most critical natural resource. And how can we make sure that water is allocated for food production? So it gets into something a little mundane, perhaps, which is this sort of sitting down and looking at land use plans and zoning practices and where the developer is going to put their next subdivision, and thinking sort of creatively and long term about how we protect our land and natural resource base to give a much higher priority to food and farming and ranching. So that, to me, is kind of where we, if we start to become more deliberate and more intentional and realize how important food is, these are the places where we can begin at a very local level. And, of course, and that's as food citizens and getting involved that way. But as food consumers, there's more we can do to demand certain kind of food.
In preparing to talk to you, I started doing some calculations of what it would take for New Mexico, whether it was even possible for New Mexico, with the tiny amount of rainfall that we have on this vast desert state, to be food self-sufficient with a population of 2 million people. And I thought, this is absolutely impossible. There's no way the numbers are going to work. Again, this is a preliminary calculation. I didn't spend weeks on it. I just spent an hour or two. But it looks like we could be food self-sufficient in the state of New Mexico if we didn't use feedlot beef, because that takes up just an insane amount of water, and if we didn't produce just export crops, but if we produced crops for us to eat. The economics of that, however, are not something that necessarily work.
Our system of agriculture, as it has evolved in New Mexico and many other places also, is completely out of line with both the capacity of our natural resources as well as the needs of our people. And it's fascinating that that in these days of industrial agriculture, farming and the whole kind of segment of the farming industry will choose a place to locate not because it's interested in feeding the people who live there. It's interested in producing as much food as possible for these large commodity markets that go into processed food products that are shipped overseas, et cetera, et cetera. So there's, of course, no consideration at all about what the health needs are of people. So, the goals of the agricultural industry are completely different than the goals of people like you and me, who look at the need to feed people who live here first and to feed them well, and for that food to be produced sustainably. That's the basic problem. So, yes. So just take one example. If we were thinking about feeding the people who lived here first, we wouldn't have these large factory dairy farms, for instance, which use a tremendous amount of water, which
are
using,
put out a tremendous amount of pollution.
Tremendous amount of. I mean, 2/3 of the dairy farms in this state are not in compliance with their groundwater discharge permits, which means they're polluting the groundwater beyond the levels that are allowed and that are dangerous to human and environmental health.
Groundwater that eventually goes into the drinking water.
It's in our aquifers, and other groundwater sources. And this is that's been the result of an industry that produces a tremendous amount of dairy products, which go into processed dairy, like the kind of cheese toppings that you get in places like Domino's, and then products like Cheese Whiz and things that are not, for the most part, very good for you. And this is how. So we're orienting our food production toward this kind of exporting, highly processed food industry model, when in fact, we have one or two organic dairy farms in this entire state, which is where the demand is. What do people want? They want more organic dairy products. I don't believe we have any cow cheese operations. If we do, they're very small. We have a lot of goat cheese producers, but we don't have many cow cheese producers. There's a tremendous demand for those products.
You mean that are organic?
Organic, yes. Organic organic cheese production, that's where the milk is coming, the cheese being produced from cow's milk. We're not looking at demand and consumer preference. We're looking at the needs of the industry first. And if there's one thing here that I think we have to keep in mind more than any other, you know, agriculture has this sort of, and I'm going to say agriculture in the big A, big ag, industrial form, has a sense of entitlement about them. You know, and you see it play out in the politics of agriculture here in the state. You see it play out in the way they deal with the environment. They think they come first, no matter what. They think that because they're a large part of the economic sector, their needs to to reduce any regulations that will restrict pollution, regulations that will reduce their abusive practices of labor, all that should be tucked away somewhere else because their needs to become a viable industry supersede everything else. And I don't even think I'm exaggerating when I make, because I see it play out in the state legislature, I see it play out in the governor's office, and I see it play out at the community level.
And this small, so-called small business task force, whose only goal seems to be to eliminate environmental regulations.
It's a horror show. I mean, and they're really looking at, we're going to take away every regulation that has an adverse impact, according to the industry. I go back to my discussion about food democracy. You know, where do we get to participate as citizens? Well, you know, when the big ag industries are making large contributions to our political elected officials, we as citizens have less access, and we are not able to make those kinds of contributions. Bills that have been introduced in the past few years just to provide basic protections for workers, for the environment, for good regulatory practices when it comes to, say, the dairy industry, they've been stepped on every time by the industry. And this is, you're talking about a very, very small percentage of the population that's might be benefiting from these industries. So We're very much out of balance at this point in time.
We're talking to Mark Winnie about his book, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. And we're going to get to the fighting part in just a second. But first, want to just give you the phone number again to call in. It is the KSFR Fund Drive, 505-428-1393, 428-1393. Give a call. Make the phones ring, ring, ring. Get a copy of this book. Or don't get a copy of this book, but contribute anyway to KSFR so that programs like this and all of our programs on KSFR can stay on the air for another few months. We are kind of living, talking about food, we're living hand to mouth, just like a lot of other people, and we rely on the contributions of every listener, whatever you can afford. $5, $500, more, less, anything in between. Just give a call right now. Make a contribution to KSFR. We will be so grateful. We will read your name on the air if you want, or not if you don't want, right at the end of the program. So, Mark Winnie, let's talk about fighting back. I mean, what power do the people have in this very daunting situation of what is essentially a kind of great big political bought-off reality?
I have my little mantra. My little mantra is to get your hands in the dirt, get your veggies on the chopping block, and get your voices down at City Hall. And what that means is that we're all going to become more effective food consumers and also food citizens if we're growing a little bit of our own food. I think that at a level of individual responsibility, we have to take responsibility for learning how to cook. Many of us simply don't know how to cook, or we don't know how to cook healthfully. I've seen some surveys that said, in some places, that said 50% of the people simply don't know how to cook. And again, if you get yourself more involved in food and cooking, you become more responsible and you get more engaged. I just see it happen all the time. And starting young means that you're going to harvest a crop of young people who are going to be really effective in terms of taking care of themselves and taking better control of the community.
You have all these college students whom you've spoken to over the years, and recently you travel around talking about the book. How do they respond?
They're amazing. I mean, I just can't get enough of these college students these days. I mean, I have a chapter on my going to my own alma mater, which had made food. They dedicated an entire academic year to food, and it was phenomenal. So I spent some time there talking with students, and they were so excited by, you know, changes in the cafeteria, changes in the quality of the food. This college bought 30% of all of its food from local sources, from within about a 50-mile radius of the campus. So farmers, processors, distributors, all, I mean, local, very, very interested in how they can help the local economy by buying food locally. I mean, why not? Isn't that that's a win-win right there? And at the same time, the students become more conscious of where that food is coming from and what the economic impact is of those purchasing practices. In the classroom, they're talking more and more. There's courses all over the place. Every college, every university, you know, whether it's the, you know, food and the economy, food and the environment, food and gender studies. I mean, it goes on and on. And that, I just wish I was back in college.
You wouldn't be inventing the wheel.
I wouldn't be
basically
writing this book, probably.
Yeah.
I'd be doing something else because it would already have been done by now. So it's definitely that kind of it's a quiet revolution in a way that so many millions of college students are really getting religion around healthy food, sustainably produced food, and food democracy and food justice. I mean, these are students that care that everybody in a community has access to good, healthy food. It's not just for an educated or wealthy elite.
Mark Winnie is the author of Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas, published by Beacon Press, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. It's just about time to go. One more plug for this fund drive, 505-428-1393.
And I will sign the books, all the books you give away.
Yay.
I will come in and make sure that they get signed. And I can tell you from past experience, my signature adds at least 10 cents in value to every book.
But the spiritual value is inestimable.
Oh, it is, exactly. Couldn't say it better myself.
428-1393 is the number, and we're going to get a report from the control room in just a second how we have done this hour. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Now, I just want to thank everybody who is in the control room right now, who is in the phone room right now, who's taking all these calls. Let the phone ring off the hook till the top of the hour and beyond. 505-428-1393. Thank you so much to all of our KSFR listeners. Thank you so much, Mark Winnie.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.